Well, we often hear that our Thanksgiving birding show is one of our listeners' favorites, and we love to bring it to you, especially since it means an opportunity to learn from experts like Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing your holiday with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're really glad to have you with us. Bill Volkert recently retired as a wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. He is now a freelance naturalist, leading some really interesting and fun trips and doing all kinds of other things that we'll hear about. Bill, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thanks. Always a pleasure to be on.
And happy Thanksgiving to you.
Well, thank you, and to you and all the listeners as well.
And Noel Cutright is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Noel, thanks as always for sharing your holiday with us.
Yes, and this is my definite favorite of the holiday programs that we do.
Well, and I hear from so many people, coworkers, friends, listeners, that they love listening to it while they're in the car going to visit friends and family or while they're cooking or while they're sitting around. So I know that a lot of people look forward to this every year, as do the three of us and Larry, too, when he's here. And, you know, there's always so much to talk about, but I want to make sure our listeners know how they can join the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question, comment, or a picture on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mehler Show, and Mehler is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And just a reminder that you don't need to be a member of Facebook to be able to see the things that we post there, and we have some great resources there already. We have a link to the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology's Christmas Bird Count page. We also have a link to Bill Volkert's naturalist website. We also have a list of the birds that Bill saw from his deer hunting tree stand, which we will talk about. Lots of great information there. So definitely check that out. It's The Larry Mehler Show on Facebook. So this past month, I want to get to this right away because I was so excited to hear this. This past month has been unprecedented, with no fewer than 6 Rufus Allen's type hummingbirds in Wisconsin. You know, I have a bookmark in my office from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology with a photo of a Rufus hummingbird on it, and it is spectacular. Noel, you want to tell us about that?
Yes, this has been kind of an unprecedented fall for the number of late hummingbirds we've had. There's actually still a ruby-throated hummingbird, at least that was a few days ago, up in Howard's Grove in Sheboygan. But the excitement has been over our Rufus hummingbird, which we often get maybe one or two, but this year we've had like a half a dozen. They've been scattered all over the state this fall, from Portage County to one here in Port Washington, Ozaukee County, where I am, one in Columbia County, St. Croix County, La Crosse County, Price County. So it's just been an amazing fall, and I guess that's one of the things we urge people to not take the hummingbird feeders down too early in the fall, because these birds are going to migrate when they're ready to do so. We're not causing them to linger where they're going to freeze to death. So
right. And now you encourage people to report all kinds of sightings, but certainly sightings of something unusual like that. How can people report things?
Well, you can go into the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology website, or the Wisconsin eBird, that's E-B-I-R-D site, or if you can get my email address from your website, you can just send me an email.
And that helped. How does that help professional ornithologists or researchers? What information does that give them?
Well, the reason we do surveys and other types of work to try to track birds, because it tells us something what's going on in the environment and what's happening with the distribution and abundance of some of these species. So there's a number of monitoring programs. In fact, we have one of the most famous coming up here in a month called the Christmas Bird Count, where we're going to have 110 different 15-mile diameter circles with people going out and spending a day trying to count everything they see and hear in those circles. And this provides a long-term database for what's happening to some of our species during the wintertime, and how they're expanding or contracting their ranges. And the same thing with reporting these rarities, because something that might be rare today, 10 years or 20 years from now, this might be a routine thing.
Hmm. And are there some examples of that, Bill, maybe you can jump in, of birds that today are really thought of as, you know, maybe not common, but certainly not rare or unusual, but that, like Noel said, 10 or 20 years ago might have been really surprising to see?
Well, the most obvious one, I think, for most of us is the wild turkey, a bird that was gone, basically locally extinct or extirpated from Wisconsin in the late 1800s. We brought them back in 76, and now take a look. They're everywhere,
mm-hmm.
except the far northeast. It's been an incredible return. Another one that I don't think people are that aware of, it's a little more than 20 years, but Canada geese. 50 years ago, biologists were seriously concerned about the decline and near disappearance of them. Now we don't even think about it.
I was going to say, that's hard to imagine today.
Yeah, and I commonly will even remind people of that and kind of shake a little bit of their awareness that these are birds that have really turned around. Bald eagles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They really have made a comeback, and Wisconsin's got the largest nesting population in the 48 states. White pelicans, definitely in the last 20 years. We had just the irregular migrants stopping in Wisconsin. Now we've got a number of colonies and very successful, and they continue to expand their range and increase in numbers.
I remember
so
the first.
Said, oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I remember the first time that I saw a large group of white pelicans. I was driving to La Crosse. This is probably a decade ago, and looked in the river and thought, that cannot be what I think I'm seeing. You know, it just seems so strange. And I asked a waitress at a restaurant. She said, yep, we've got, you know, a few hundred pelicans that come through here and spend.
It was not a bird that you ever associated with Wisconsin.
Exactly, exactly.
And I remember the first good population we had at Horicon Marsh. People would come in and almost very hesitantly looking around and kind of confide, go, I think I might have seen a pelican.
Right.
And we say, oh, sure, we've got them here. They're relieved because they thought they're either hallucinating or completely misidentifying
right.
something.
Well, and a pelican is pretty, you think a pelican is pretty easily identifiable, but yeah, it's such a dissonance where you're seeing them.
Yeah, well, it's more unbelievable. But nowadays, you know, they're all over, and I think most people probably have seen them in Wisconsin and are quite aware of it. So, as Noel said, the status of these birds continues to change, and we want to track and monitor that to see what's happening. And any of those that we see serious declines on, we certainly want to be able to act to make sure that they don't slip toward a threatened or endangered status. And others, as they become more widespread and abundant, we're trying to figure out what is it responding to and why are they doing so well.
Well, and you mentioned both turkeys and Canada geese, so I happen to have some audio here. So let's take a listen to both of those. You know, certainly turkeys, we think of the gobble, 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 but that's not what they're doing this time of year.
Right. That is the spring mating. So, you know, to do the little putts and clucks that that they give at this time of year, it doesn't really catch an ear, especially for the advertisers who want to associate the turkey with the Thanksgiving
right.
tradition.
Well, let's take a listen.
The gobble that you hear is only going to be heard in the wild in spring.
Let's take a listen to what the turkeys might be sounding like this time of year. So those were actually two different types of non-gobble calls that I put together. Noel, do you want to tell us what we were hearing?
Yeah, this is what the hunters in the fall try to imitate, to try to attract turkeys. And I think there's even some deer hunters that, since deer are kind of curious sometimes, I think they might respond to turkey. I actually heard a local deer hunter near me making that call.
Hmm. And Bill, did you want to add anything there?
Well, these are the contact calls. So think a little bit about the annual biology of the bird. You've got the mating in spring. That's the gobbling. That's what we hear when the big toms are trying to attract the mates. At this time of year, we've got the family groups and flocks, and it's simply warning each other of danger, staying in contact with each other. These are communication calls. And we've mentioned this in past programs, there's a real distinction between what we think of as bird songs,
mm-hmm.
which are for courtship and mate selection, and calls, which they do throughout the year, the warnings, the contact, food, and other types of information that they may convey through those little putts, clucks, chips, and things that we hear out in the woods.
We're talking about bird watching with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Happy Thanksgiving to you. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we had also mentioned Canada geese as a species that has really come back from the brink and in a big way. Let's listen to what the geese sound like. I think this is a pretty familiar one for most people, but let's just play it. So quite a cacophony to start out with, and then one little hanger on there at the end.
I think this is a sound that is so typical of Wisconsin and its big marshes that, to me, I don't think it would even be fall if we didn't have that sound mm-hmm. of Canada geese calling in the background. It just seems to mark the season for me.
And another bird that is pretty audible this time of year is the tundra swan. And, Bill, are we seeing a lot of tundra swans in Wisconsin right now?
Yes. Tundra swans, true to their name, they nest up in the Arctic. There's a small population around Hudson Bay. Most of them go up to the far north slope of Alaska. And they have a very unusual migration where most birds go more or less north-south. Tundra swans are going from Alaska across the entire continent toward the east coast, especially around Chesapeake Bay. And with some of the big fronts and changing weather, they've bailed out of the Arctic. They've moved through the Dakotas, and now they're sitting out in the Mississippi and a number of the large marshes in Wisconsin. And this is the time of year for them to be moving through. And I would also suspect, with the strong front and the change in weather we're expecting, they're probably going to pick up on that. And I would say that tomorrow and over the weekend, we should see a nice migration of sandhill cranes and tundra swans as they're moving, and they will even continue to move through the night. And this is why I would suggest that people get familiar with the call, because we've got rather short daylight, and you might hear the tundra swans overhead. And to me, it's not that sort of raucous call of a goose. It's more of a soft moan and just a beautiful sound.
Well, and actually, let's take a listen, because I do have some of that audio as well. This is the tundra swan.
You know, when they're flying over, they're going to be pretty high, and you probably won't hear them that loud, but it's amazing how far that sound will travel. And I agree with Bill with this, what they're predicting with this front coming through, over the next couple of days. I expect these birds, there's going to be Canada geese moving some, but especially sandhill cranes and tundra swans are really going to be moving, I think.
And, Noel, tundra swans are, when we hear the word swan, at least I think of these big, pretty majestic birds, but tundra swans are a little on the smaller side, aren't they?
Well, they're still pretty large. They're not quite as large as a trumpeter swan, but they're huge birds.
Oh, okay. Okay. And you also mentioned sandhill cranes being on the move, so surprisingly enough, I have that audio, too. So let's listen.
You're fantastic this morning.
Well, thank you. I actually have a lot of fun preparing for these birding shows, because I do get to pull some audio that we can all listen to and have, people like the two of you explain them for us is really just wonderful. So
you do a wonderful job with Bill and me and the listeners.
Oh, well, thank you. And let's listen to that sandhill, because, that's another one that so many of us are fortunate here in Wisconsin to be able to see and hear. It almost sounds like someone hammering or knocking on wood. It's a very woody kind of sound.
Yeah, in the
fall, that little gurgle to it, yes.
They have staging areas that are kind of well known, and people can go out and watch them come in the evenings, and you can get 100, maybe even as many as 1,000 in one staging area. And most of the cranes will be flying out of Wisconsin here in the coming weeks are heading kind of southeast. And their main stopping point south of us is Jasper-Pulaski Wildlife Area in northwestern Indiana.
Hmm. Well, we are talking with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright about bird watching. It's a Thanksgiving tradition here on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, and we appreciate you spending part of your holiday with us on the Ideas Network. We are talking about birds and bird watching on this Thanksgiving day. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller and visiting with some of my favorites, and I know your favorites as well, Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. They are both passionate and experienced birders, and they're happy to share what they know with you. And Bill and Noel, we have quite a few people waiting to talk with you, so let's go to the phones and Cynthia in Madison. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too. Thank you for the show. I have a question about the beautiful and simple juncos that come in every fall. And last year, I saw something that had, I would identify in a book as an Oregon junco with a black head, clear ring around its body, brown body, and light underside. And given where we're located, is there something else it could be in this area, or was that a wandering Oregon junco?
You probably did a good job identifying it, description, and we'd occasionally get them here in the States. They're not rare, but they are uncommon. But if you look at enough juncos throughout the winter, you'll probably find an Oregon type or two.
And the funny thing is, of course, there is Oregon, Wisconsin, just south of Madison, but I'm guessing it's not that Oregon junco. Although maybe it's a new kind of Oregon junco. I have to say, I'm with Cynthia. I'm a huge fan of juncos. There's something about them that, even though they really are kind of a sign of winter setting in, there's something I find really cheery about them.
They are a member of the sparrow family. They're common in the backyard, so easily visit our backyards. So it's one of those birds that is easily attracted to our feeders. I used to band some of the juncos around the backyard, and I would actually have returns of the same bird 3-4 years later. They actually knew where my feeders were. And I agree with you. They're just kind of a cheery little bird. That gray and white, not real spectacular color, but yet it's nice and sleek. It's got just kind of a nice plumage to it. A little flash of white on each side of the tail. Some people have referred to it, among other birds, as the snowbird. And oftentimes, I think the folklore is we don't see it until the snow flies. Mm. They actually arrive in Wisconsin late September, early October, coming down from northern Wisconsin and in Canada. And it really isn't until the weather turns and we get a little more lack of food in the wild and eventually the snow that they really are driven to the feeders in big numbers. But they are here much earlier than that.
And it seems like I see them hopping around on the ground picking up seeds that have gotten either fallen out of or thrown out of the feeders more than actually on the feeders themselves.
They're definitely ground feeders.
Yep. Okay.
And if you're driving a back road and see a flock of birds fly up along the shoulder of the road, you see a lot of white. Those will be juncos because they have white outer tail feathers, and those are very conspicuous in flight.
Am I remembering correctly that they also have a lighter colored beak?
Yes, they do.
Mm-hmm. Pinkish, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I really like them. I often leave, I'll pretend it's on purpose, but it's usually because I don't get around to doing the garden cleanup. But I often have a lot of dried stalks or flower stems, things like that. And they seem to like hopping among those, but also once in a while kind of perching on one. But I've rarely seen one actually up on the feeder. Well, thanks for that call, Cynthia. And Kay in Maryland actually has a comment about a bird that came with the juncos. Hi, Kay.
Hi. Maryland is in Jackson County.
Okay.
And this year when the leaves all fell, late September, early October, around that time, there was a flock of juncos, and there was this little bird with them, and it was all white, had little black cheeks, black eyes, little black beak, and just a touch of black on its body, not much, but it was just snow white. Any clue about the size of a junco chickadee?
Hmm.
Sounds like snow bunting.
It could be a snow bunting mixed in with the juncos, yes.
Oh, cool. Where are they from?
Way far north.
A high Arctic nester.
Really?
They nest north of Hudson Bay.
Wow.
I found a nest one year up on Ellesmere Island in a pile of rocks. So that's 1,000 miles above the Arctic Circle. They'll go as far north as there's land. They are related to the sparrows, our North American sparrows. They like the big open fields, and some of the best places to find them in Wisconsin, around Horicon Marsh, around Stevens Point, along the Lake Michigan lakefront, some of that open farmland, and basically the areas that look sort of tundra-like. They love those big, open, wide-swept areas.
Wow.
And for them, Wisconsin is down south.
It's so what do you call it?
Snow bunting.
Snow bunting. I got to write that down. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kate.
Sure, good sighting.
Bye.
Well, yeah.
Look in agricultural fields for them. Really windswept. They love to feed in manure that's been spread out on the snow in the wintertime. And they're just arriving now. We have a group here in southeastern Wisconsin. We hope they have enough. They were kind of uncommon last year because we didn't have much snow around. But we actually hope to do some banding of snow bunnings, attract them to some green and have traps there and band them because they are a declining species, and there's a major effort in southern Canada to learn more about where they're breeding. Because some of our birds that appear here may head northwest. Others may head toward Greenland in the northeast.
Mm. Well, and as we mentioned early on, one of the amazing things about birding is that it really seems like there are no 2 years that are the same.
That's correct.
Definitely not. That's what keeps it exciting, I think.
Well, Bill, you were doing some deer hunting like many, many people in Wisconsin, and you also used your time very well in your tree stand to do some birding as well. At last count that you let me know about, at least, you're at 33 species just from that one vantage point. And we actually put a list of those up on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can see all of the birds that Bill has seen. And what were some of the unusual or exciting ones for you?
Just on Monday, I had a bald eagle come by. That was always exciting. Made a couple of circles around the area. The gulls were a little excited about that. He disappeared. Red-shouldered hawk. I do have a small population around the neighborhood, and sometimes they'll stick around late in the year, or even a few individuals might remain through the winter. Heard them calling. Of course, like a lot of deer hunters, sometimes you get up bright and early, so the owls are still calling. I had great horned and barred owl. Barred owls were calling this morning again. And one of the real thrills I had, and it happened again just earlier this morning, little brown creeper, just a tiny bird that just loves to cling to the side of the bark. They always work their way from the bottom of the tree up, probing around, looking for any insects and food. And I had one within 5 feet of me in the adjacent birch tree, just going up and down. I wish I had a camera. It was really just fun to watch, and I think anybody who's ever spent time waiting for deer can testify you'll see a lot more birds than you will deer throughout any day.
It sounded like that was Larry's experience last weekend, actually.
So, yeah, it keeps it exciting. I decided to actually just write them down this year, keep a little checklist. Today I added red-breasted nuthatch, which I was expecting would be around, but hadn't heard it up till now. And then I had two short calls, which sounded very much like the little call note of song sparrow, and never called again, seemed to have disappeared. But then it clicked in my mind that also the winter wren has a very similar call. It tends to be a little bit softer, a little more accented, and he tends to be a little more chatty, a little more repetitious. Hmm. But I only heard one call that caught my attention. Another one I listened is like, okay, come on, let me try to distinguish, and that was it. So it could have been a late song sparrow or winter wren, which neither one would be too unexpected, but couldn't confirm it.
So obviously a lot of the time during these shows, we talk about identifying birds by their call because a lot of times, especially when there's heavy foliage, it's a lot easier to hear them than to see them. How did each of you go about, if you went about learning different calls, did you do it in a very methodical way, or did you learn them as a particular bird appeared and you looked into it? Noel, why don't you start?
Well, I started quite early, and it's essentially if you hear a bird, don't know what it is, you get your binoculars and you track it down until you see it. And if you can hear that bird singing while you're watching it, I think it really sticks with you much better than trying to pick it out on a recording of some kind or have someone just say, oh, there's a cardinal singing. You know, if you can actually see that cardinal sing, I think it sticks with you. So
you basically did it as you heard a bird, didn't know what it was, tracked it down, watched it, and then it kind of sunk in that way.
And I still do that. I mean, every year I always hear some birds that I'm not sure of, or maybe they're singing a little bit of an odd song, and I'll try to track them down to actually watch them make the song.
And Bill, what about you?
Well, I think it's just kind of an evolution of developing your birding skills. You try to first learn them by sight, and since it is obviously a group of animals that are both very visible, nice and colorful, and very vocal, It's just a way to tune it, and as Noel indicated, it's a really fantastic skill to have to expand your identification and detection techniques. And as I would cross paths with other birders and people who are studying birds, every once in a while you realize that somebody else is familiar with a bird by a call or a song, and you want to expand a little bit on your own abilities or sharing information. Sometimes I just didn't have an ear for one. I'd hear it and just didn't click. Somebody give me a little phrase or a hint. Or as Noel said, watch it and get that mental picture.
Right.
The one thing I always remind people of is learning bird songs and calls is literally like learning a foreign language.
Hmm.
You've ever tried it, you've probably seen movies where people, put onto cassette tape, the headphones fall asleep, and they're perfectly fluent in Italian the next day. It takes years of practice and just repetition.
It does.
And you learn them one at a time, the same way you do by identification from your book and from your own experience. And you literally have to develop an ear for it. And as you get a bit of an ear for it and a familiarity, you actually start to refine a little bit and become more discriminatory in your hearing.
Hmm.
And so you'll hear people describing, the chips are just a little bit sharper, a little sweeter and softer, and yet, to us, it may just sound like a chip, but if you listen close enough and compare enough, there are some subtle differences that oftentimes can distinguish these species, and little by little, you start to pick up a bit of a repertoire of it. It takes some time, and it takes a lot of repetition, but it is fun, and it's always easier to hear birds than it is to see them. And just like Noel, every year I pick up something new. And I suppose every so often, if I haven't heard it for a while, I also forget a few
sure.
over time.
Well, I think all of us listening to the two of you talk would say with confidence that you are both fluent in bird. So you might not be good in Italian, but you're fluent in bird. Well, you just mentioned, Bill, having little phrases that kind of, help cement those calls in our memories. Sue from Neshota emailed and said, while walking outside from spring through fall, I often hear a bird song that sounds like cheeseburger. Any idea what that bird might be?
I don't.
Yeah, the problem here is when we say cheeseburger or Phoebe, Pee-wee, we're getting the rhythm of the song.
Mm-hmm.
So here we've got something that's sort of long, slightly drawn out the first note, and then two more with a slight drop-off. We're not getting the tonal quality
right.
of the voice. And, of course, that's the problem, is we can't imitate most of them very well either.
Or what sounds like cheeseburger to Sue might sound like something different to you, and if
yeah.
you heard that right away, you'd know
In
what
fact,
it was.
Interestingly, I read something years ago where somebody was looking at the simple call of a rooster and how different languages have given
yes,
it.
Yes, they're totally
different.
We do the
cock-a-doodle-doo.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't really sound like it. In German, it's kikiriki. Japanese has something quite similar. And, they went through about a half a dozen languages, and some seem to capture it better than others, but everybody tries. They get the rhythm right, but they don't always get that accenting of the notes.
Right. We are talking with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. They are birding experts and are happy to hear your observations, answer your questions. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our on-air producer today is Dave Potraz. He will be happy to answer your calls. And let's go back to the phone and Bill in Plover next. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
What's your question?
The question was, is I'm wondering how the birds that nest in mature forest, interior forest, how well they're doing, like some of the warblers. So that's the question.
Okay. And Noel, do you want to take a stab at that?
Well, as usual, when we talk about birds, it seems like there's about a third of the birds that are declining in number, a third that are increasing, and a third that are pretty stable. And some of our forest nesting birds are doing quite well, but there's also other species like the cerulean warbler, which is mostly in the southern part of the state, and the hooded warbler also, and they're not doing real well. So there's a number of species are declining. There are some that are doing quite well. We always think about wood thrushes and scarlet tanagers and some of our most beautiful, not only to look at but to hear birds. In woodlands, and again, it's a case-by-case basis, so you really have to talk about what particular species you're talking about, because they can be inclining or declining or holding their own.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Bill. And let's go next to Dan in Beaver Dam. Hi, Dan. Dan, are
Hello,
you there?
Yes, I am.
Great.
Hello. This is a question for Bill. I was wondering, Bill, if you knew the status of the mallard migration this year. I live in Dodge County. We've hunted grain fields near Horicon Marsh for years and years. And other than the local mallards, we have literally not seen a mallard in the field for about 5 weeks. Just wondering if you got a take on that.
Well, like a lot of birds, that migration is driven by the weather. And take a look at the fall that we've had. We've had some very calm, very steady, extremely warm temperatures with south wind, which is certainly not advantageous to a southerly migration. And then we're a couple of cold fronts. About a little more than a week ago, we had some cold weather that came through, and now for the past week, we've been at near record temperatures again. So I think what we had was a lot of birds sitting very late and then probably rushing through with some of those good fronts. And you'll oftentimes get this where birds may stall out, where the weather may be nice, and then all of a sudden they're trying to make up for lost time. For example, in springtime, we've had years where the spring has been very slow, and then all of a sudden we get a good south wind, and the migrant warblers will just pass right over southern Wisconsin, and we hardly see them here, and they're already on the nesting ground. So normally, in a typical year, birds tend to come down with periodic fronts, making these small jumps. We'll sit for a while, populations will build up, and then as we get these periodic cold fronts coming through, we'll get a slow movement, a build-up, and eventual departure. But with the weather the way it's been, I think that we probably had a lot of birds that were sitting up north with relatively mild weather, and then with a good cold front where it may have been chilly for us, but I know out in the Dakota, southern Canada, they had ice. And once you get ice on the water, the ducks have to depart because there's no access to food.
Right.
I think some of them may have
skipped over
pretty quickly.
Okay. And I got one more question for Bill. Bill, have you noticed the increased number of seagulls in our area?
Oh, this is something over the last 20 years, especially for people in the inland counties in some of the farming areas of Wisconsin. And, of course, Fond du Lac, Dodge, Columbia County are very productive farmland areas. Gulls are primarily out along the Great Lakes, Lake Winnebago, the big water. That's where you expect them. But something that I've noticed that they've seemed to have picked up on over the past couple of decades is the fall plowing of the farmers turns the soil, brings up a lot of insect grubs, and it's a seasonally available food supply, and especially the ringbill gulls, which are a little bit more general in terms of their food habits and habitat preferences. They move inland, and I've oftentimes seen fields where they're just white with gulls, and as the farmer comes back again, the big swarm picks up, gets out of the way of the tractor, comes back down looking for any freshly exposed food. And, gulls have certainly increased in general in their numbers, and also I think with this habit of moving inland, especially in the fall time, to take advantage of that seasonally available food that's being churned up.
And actually, I have to say, I saw a bunch of gulls in a field between Milwaukee and Madison last weekend, and they were definitely gulls. So I think they were probably looking for the same things you were talking about, Bill. Thanks for that call, Dan. And Noel, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
I want to add something on your last call, talking about putting words to bird song. That's called bird mnemonics, and I just sent you a whole list of those. You can go online and find a list of. And then my daughter just emailed me, and she says the cheeseburger is really a chickadee.
Ah, there we go.
I always think of
another one.
Phoebe, but it's, you know, you put Phoebe, cheeseburger.
Another one occurred to me, Noel, cheeseburger, of course, is three syllables.
Right.
And I'm wondering, another possibility, the blue jay, which I think might actually be their call. I think of it as them saying, we did it, sort of that squeaky pump handle.
Mm-hmm.
That's another one that comes to my mind as three syllables. That's the best guess I've got.
All right. Well, all this talk of cheeseburgers is making me hungry.
I'm waiting for turkey here.
I was going to say, good thing I've got it. Actually, we're doing a roast chicken today instead of a turkey. It's a smaller group, but all the fixins alongside of it. So, you know, because it's really, for me, I think it's mostly about the fixins.
Yes.
Anyway.
Can't beat stuffing.
Exactly. Yeah, I make a good cornbread one. So I'm looking forward to that. Linda posted on our Facebook page, I just wanted to share a sighting from last November. I live in the country by New Holstein. Saw a shrike in the top of a young maple tree. First one I've ever seen in all the years I've been bird watching. I'd like to think it was a loggerhead, but not sure. It took off before I could get a photograph. A couple days later, saw a bird at a distance flying similar to a kestrel. It would hover low to the ground, pop up, move 10 feet, and back down again. What would the shrike flight pattern be when they're hunting for food?
They will occasionally hover, but they kind of have a swooping flight. So it's a possibility. Did she mention when she saw it, month-wise?
She said last November.
Last November. It was probably a northern shrike then. The loggerheads are an endangered species here in the state. There's very, 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 very few of them. They're last kind of strongholds up in the St. Croix Valley. But, you know, I've not seen one this year, and I don't expect to see one. But, you know, with northern shrikes are coming down for the winter from their northern breeding grounds. And they'll be with us throughout the winter. So I would expect that's what she saw.
And as a predatory bird, they're very swift. They're about the size of a blue jay, very grayish with a little black on the wing and face. And they have this very fast, rapid wing beat. And they seem to be able to accelerate and maneuver very quickly, which, of course, is an advantage for hunting, whether it's large insects, small birds, and small mammals that they will take. So they've got a very distinctive flight. It's not, say, the sort of slow, lazy flight of a blue jay. It's a very fast wing beat, and you'll see them shoot across the field and just hit the brakes and perch right on top of the one lone tree, looking for, as kind of a lookout, using that to look for prey and then take off rapidly again. So they, even the flight pattern is very distinctive.
Wow. Great sighting. Thanks for sharing that. Jerome wrote and said, I think I had a female merlin in my yard in River Falls. Is that possible? It was a lovely bird, not a kestrel. It did not have those colorations.
Yeah, we can get merlins at any time of year, so yes, it's definitely a possibility. It's a species that's increasing. They tend to use old crow nest to nest, and will very often be in a spruce tree, even in an urban area. So seeing one hanging around most any time of year is possible just about anywhere in Wisconsin.
Bill, can you tell us a little more about merlins, because that's not as familiar a species for me, at least.
Yeah, merlin is a falcon, and in Wisconsin there are four species of falcons. The little kestrel, which is fairly common and throughout the summertime and occasionally will remain in the wintertime. Merlin's a little bit larger than that, and I think of it as a chunky kestrel if you see it from a bit of a distance. The female is very dark brown speckled, the male sort of blackish gray. A little bit larger than that is the peregrine falcon, which we have successfully reintroduced back into Wisconsin, and they are nesting along the Mississippi River, along the Great Lakes shoreline. There's artificial boxes that have been put up, and also Madison area. And then we get occasionally a very rare visitor from high Arctic. This is the gyr falcon, a very large bird. Not that common in Wisconsin, always an exciting one. But the merlin, the old name, if you have an older field book, a field guide would refer to it as pigeon hawk.
Oh, okay.
And it's a bird of the spruce forest, and as Noel said, it is increasing. And in the last, about 12, 15 years, we've had an increasing number of merlins nesting in northern Wisconsin. For those people, say, in Vilas, Iron County, and over toward Douglas, Forest County, that northern tier of counties, we've got a scattered population of merlins up there. And if I travel there in spring or summer, I will occasionally hear them or even see them in northern Wisconsin. And at this time of year, we're getting that migration of those birds where the bigger population is in the spruce forest of Canada, heading south, moving out, and they may show up almost anywhere in Wisconsin at this time of year, from people's backyards to out in the wild.
You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry today. Happy Thanksgiving. We are pleased to have Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright with us, as always, on Thanksgiving to talk about bird watching and to hear your observations and answer your questions. We'll be back with Bill and Noel in just a moment. talking about birds and bird watching with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. Bill was for many years a wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center and is now a freelance naturalist doing lots of really interesting things. Noel Cutright is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. And Bill and Noel, we're always so happy to have you spend your holiday with us. So thanks again. It really is a very special show that we're able to do. Thanks to you, too.
Absolutely.
Well,
it's
Sally
and the thrill.
Oh, it's so much fun. I really enjoy it, and I know our listeners do. So let's go back to the phones and Sally in Middleton next. Hi, Sally.
Hi, thanks. I always enjoy these programs and finding out things because I don't think you ever know at all. I'm 80, and I don't go out on track. Never was an early riser, so never went out at the 6 a.m., you know, get-togethers and go bird watching, even though I've been a member of Audubon and subscriber to the magazine for years and years. So I was so lucky. When I looked out my kitchen window about a year ago, it may have been 2 years. I think it was a year ago, and that was when we were having low food in Canada, not much access to food. It was a bad year, winter. It was winter. So early spring, I looked out my kitchen window, and about 10 feet away at my bird bath. By the way, I love that bird bath. It really brings them in to drink and even bathe, but even year-round. Anyway, there's always birds at it. Anytime I look out, there'll be a bird there getting a little drink. I looked out, and 10 feet away was a white, darling, snowy owl. When you say, oh, do you know what you're thinking of in your mind? Do you know, can you picture one?
Oh, yeah.
Well, and
well,
last
I know you two can, but
beautiful. Pure white.
Absolutely. And last year, didn't we have an amazing influx of snowy owls?
There was a very large influx, a historic influx of snowy owls from the north. There's a few been showing up. In fact, I just read an email this morning of a fellow who watched two snowy owls on the breakwater in Sheboygan. And they were actually playing hopscotch with the fishermen as they were walking out because it's nice and warm today, so no danger of bad weather, icing, or anything. So the fishermen going out on the breakwaters, and these snowy owls like to perch on these breakwaters during the day. And they were actually playing hopscotch with the fishermen as they walked out on the breakwater.
They really are lovely birds.
And I sent you a wonderful photograph this morning, Judith, of a snowy owl eating a toad.
Oh.
At the Ashland Airport yesterday. And it's just a wonderful, very, very close-up picture of the head of a snowy owl. And you can see it flew down to a wet area apparently in the Ashland Airport and found this toad somehow.
Well, I will look for that and actually try to get it up on the Facebook page during the news break that we have at the top of the hour. Bill, do we know if we're going to be lucky enough to have the same kind of influx of snowy owls this year?
I wouldn't expect the same, but this may be a bit of a layover, so to speak, from last year. Snowy owls can tolerate the coldest weather, but of course they need food. And their primary food is the lemming, and lemmings tend to go through roughly a four-year population cycle. So they continue to build up in numbers in the Arctic. They overrun their food supply. The population crashes. And when we have a crash in the population of lemmings, this is when the snowy owls start to move south looking for new food. So almost every year we'll see one or two snowy owls in the upper Midwest. Usually the young ones are driven out as the parents. The adults take larger territories for the winter season to make sure they have enough food. But every 4 years, sometimes every fifth year, we get this invasion of snowy owls. And what I think happened is if we had such an unprecedented number of snowy owls last year, it must have been just a complete collapse of lemmings across a vast area of the Arctic, and it's probably very slow to build up, that there's still not enough food for the whole population to remain, and some of them are wandering south.
Because there were hundreds of sightings, weren't there?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, thanks for that call. And let's go next to Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hey, great show today.
Thanks.
I grew up in Madison, and the Cardinals here pretty much had a standard song that they did. Do a little variations, but very little. Now I'm living up in the De Pere Green Bay area, and the Cardinals have really changed their songs, and they don't seem to have one very standard one, and nothing like what I grew up with in there. And I'm wondering, do birds change their songs as time goes by, or do low-key?
What you might be running into is more of a dialect. Just in the same way that if you travel any country where people more or less speak the same language, in different regions, there will be slightly different accents. You know, we're all familiar with the New York and Boston accent, the Southern drawl, you know, the Western kind of twang that works its way into the language. And we'll see the same thing with birds if you move across a big enough geographical area. So there is, first of all, that innate song. In other words, physiologically, the way that bird is developed and it's, well, we're not really a vocal cord, but its vocal structure, that dictates the kind of sound it makes, but there's learning involved. And birds will slowly learn a little bit of a different accent, so to speak. And I remember traveling my first time out into the Dakotas. I heard something that kind of had a ring to it, but boy, it was really confusing me. I chased around for it, and it was a blue jay. Like, wow, these guys really sound different.
That's really interesting.
North of Lake Superior, the chickadees tend to call higher and faster. Yes, it's still the little Phoebe or Pee-wee sound, but it's a little bit higher, a little faster. So there are regional dialects of birds. Among the song sparrow, classical studies, some 25-plus different dialects recognized across the United States. So we have this kind of a localized learning of that, a little bit of a different accent.
That's fascinating. That's really interesting. Do we know why they develop differently, or it's just kind of a type of evolution?
From the parents, and if you're far enough away from others of your kind, you may just pick up a little bit of a different you know, language and so forth. I think we're familiar with, you know, in Wisconsin, you know, you ask for a bubbler. If you go down south, you better ask for a water fountain.
Right.
You know, we pick it up from everybody around here. It works its way into our language, but travel far enough and they'll give you a funny look. And what do you want? Same thing with the birds. They're learning from each other that refinement. So in other words, genetically and physiologically, they're tuned to make a certain kind of a voice,
mm-hmm.
but they do have a learning period. And actually that is in the early development stages, just like people. If you learn a different language as a child in those first, say, about 8-9 years of your life, you can speak it very fluently without an accent. After that, you're probably always going to have a bit of an accent mm-hmm. if you learn a new language.
Yeah, I grew up in southern Ohio, and people definitely talk different there than they do here, but cardinals also sound different down
there.
There
you go.
So it's quite recognizable.
Well, Mike, thanks for that call, and let's go next to Tom in Cedarburg. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm so glad I caught your show. Earlier you were talking about bird calling, and I've been doing that about the last 4 or 5 years. It's very interesting, I find. And it's anything from, you know, the bigger hunting birds, owls and stuff in the evening, to hawks during the day, to songbirds. I've also put out food for them, too, so that helps bring them in, too. But now that it's fall, they're not around as much, but if I go outside and I call for a while and they call back, then they'll come in and, eat and stuff like that. And I've been starting to tape some of their sounds, and I find some of the birds I never actually see. They're, like, very shy, and they'll stay in the woods and make sounds that I've not heard before, and they're very shy birds, and I've never actually seen them, but yet they'll call out. I'm wondering, is there any organizations that cater to people who call birds?
And so what would you be looking for help with exactly?
Is there organizations that, you know, for people who, you know, bird call, or I don't know.
Not that I know of. Being able to imitate birds is very difficult. A lot of people will use bird song to attract birds, as you describe, but I don't know of any organization that just does that sort of thing. There's a number of organizations from the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology up at the River Edge Bird Club, which is not too far from you. We have a number of field trips, and you can certainly help to learn your bird song by going on field trips with other knowledgeable people that can recognize these. And one of the main ways, I mean, Christmas bird counts I mentioned before are coming up. One of the things I do is when I hear a chickadee, I'll start pishing. Psh, 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 psh. And just that sound, for some reason, that gets their curiosity going, and they'll very often pop up and even fly in. And if you keep it up and have a good location where they feel safe from predators, you may end up with 20 birds all flying around you, all kind of scolding at you as you do that pitching sound.
Wow. And Bill, did you have anything to add on Tom's question?
Well, interesting that Noel mentioned pishing, because I was just waiting for a break to slip that in. It's a fantastic little technique. If you get the chickadees stirred up, oftentimes other birds are following the flocks of chickadees, and they may come in. And another group of birds that seem to be lured fairly easily by this pishing are the finches.
Right.
And the other day when I was sitting in my tree stand, I could hear some finches flying overhead. I knew they weren't goldfinches. It sounded a little like redpolls. I started pishing. I pulled a flock of 25 of them right into the tree I was sitting in, looked up above me, and great looks at the redpolls. And you can bring them right in sometimes. And so, as Noel says, just that little wishing type sound. That's where it gets its name, pishing. It's just that psh, 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 psh. And it just seems to capture that curiosity of the birds. And sometimes you may just get them to jump on a perch mm-hmm. where you at least get a decent look, or actually call them right into you.
Well, I think a lot of people will be trying out the pishing either later today or sometime over the weekend. We are talking with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. They join us for many of our holidays to talk about birds and bird watching, and they will be with us all the way up until 12:30, so I hope you will stay with us. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. So glad you chose to spend your holiday with us here on the Ideas Network. Welcome back to our wonderful Thanksgiving bird watching program that we do each Thanksgiving and on many other major holidays. We're happy to have Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright with us for those. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Whether you know almost nothing about them or have studied them your whole lives, birds are fascinating. They add to our enjoyment of Wisconsin's really wonderful natural areas, not just by sight, but by sound as well. We really appreciate you spending part of your Thanksgiving with us, and I hope you're enjoying as much as I am our conversation with Noel and Bill. Noel is a past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Great to talk with you again, Noel.
Always great to be with you guys.
And Bill Volkert's been watching and studying birds for nearly 40 years. He spent 27 of those as a naturalist at Horicon Marsh. Bill, thanks again for joining us.
We wouldn't spend Thanksgiving any other way.
Well, we have Bruce in Madison, who's been waiting quite a while to talk with you. So let's go right to the phone and find out what Bruce has on his mind. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I actually want to expand on something that you just talked about before the news break.
Great.
You talked about fishing and drawing in birds that are curious. I've for a long time had the habit of drawing in chickadees in my yard by making little fishing or smacking noises, and always been amazed how close they get to me. But last week, I did the same thing. I was pruning a crabapple near the backyard bird feeder, and there were some chickadees coming and going to the feeder, and I made a few noises and had, within a few minutes, I had about five chickadees right in the same bush I was pruning. And what interested me was that within another minute, I drew in a bunch of other birds, and they included two tufted titmice, two white-breasted nuthatches, and one red-breasted nuthatch, plus a downy woodpecker, plus the odd goldfinch.
Wow.
And so all these guys were right in my face, and I wanted to ask how to interpret this, because their behavior seemed aggressive. The tufted titmouse, the tuft on its head was sticking upright, and it was very loud. The white-breasted nuthatch was about 4 inches from my nose. And so here's this daring little bird. Everybody seemed to be quite agitated. And it seemed aggressive, and it seemed as if maybe I were an owl or something, and they were trying to get rid of me. Hmm. I just wanted to know what your guests thought about that.
Sure, and let's actually ask them to give us that pishing sound again. Noel, do you want to pish for us?
It's really P-I-S-H or P-H-I-S-H, pish.
All right, and that sounds like something even I could do. It's not
anybody can do it.
and so is that unusual, what Bruce experienced with that kind of mobbing behavior?
That's very typical. And like I say, I do it on Christmas bird counts. I kind of listen for a chickadee because they are probably the first species to respond to that kind of sound. And the longer you do it, sometimes I'll do it at one place for 3 or 4 minutes, almost until I start hyperventilating. but it's just, and they are agitated. We're not quite sure why, whether it's something strange that they here that they're not familiar with their environment and they want to get rid of and chase it out. A lot of times if you're in a woodland setting or maybe along a hedgerow with trees in it, you can see chickadees and other species sticking their head in holes or maybe knots, like they're looking for a screech owl or something. In fact, sometimes I actually have found a screech owl that way. The birds actually find it, and you start looking around for cavities, and all at once there's a screech owl sitting in one of the openings into a cavity. Hmm. But they're definitely agitated, and like I said, they'll elevate their crest feathers if they have them, or kinglets, so sometimes they'll spread those head feathers and show off their golden or ruby crowns. So that's a very common reaction.
Oh, thanks for that call, Bruce. I want to make sure that we get to this because this was really exciting to me. It's shaping up to be an amazing year for winter finches. Why is that, and what species are we talking about? Noel?
Well, it's a whole variety of species, and Bill's already mentioned, we've mentioned a couple already today, red crossbills and American goldfinches. Another species he had on his list, which is getting to be quite uncommon, and people really search for them, are evening grosbeaks. Typically, it's because the seed crops fail up in Canada, where these birds typically will spend their winter if there's enough food. So they're coming south to find food. So they'll come to feeders. They'll come to, you know, natural-type foods also, whether it's the buds on alder for red poles or whether it's box elder seeds that pine crowspeaks will come into. This year, the first one that really staged a massive eruption were red crossbills. They actually started appearing in August here in southeastern part of the state, which is really pretty amazing. And both red and white-winged crossbills are around. Good numbers of pine siskin this winter. Of course, American goldfinches are always with us.
Mm-hmm. Well, and actually, I'm going to stop you there for just a second. We did have a Madison listener who wanted to know if those evening grosbeaks, which you mentioned, will be visible here in the southern part of the state. Will they be present?
Cross your fingers. All the ones that we're hearing now are just flyovers. I'm guessing that's what Bill had in his deer stand, where a couple of, because they'll mm-hmm. call when they're in flight. I know there's been some sightings at various locations. They'll just you look out your feeder, and all at once there's an evening grosbeak sitting on your sunflower feeder.
And actually, I do have some audio of an evening grosbeak, so let's take a listen to that. And, Bill, what really stands out to you in that call?
Well, it has that sharpness with a little bit of a trill. And I guess I don't know how to explain it any further, but there is something. I've heard them enough over the years, and it always gets my ear. There's something just very grosbeak about it. I can't put it anymore. But it is characteristic of the bird, and Noel's right. That's how I picked those out
okay.
that I saw. They actually were two of them flying overhead, kind of high. But as soon as I heard that, it caught my ear. As I looked up, I could see two fairly chunky little birds flying on over my head and continuing on their way. As far as the expectation at a bird feeder, I guess the chances will increase as we get more birds coming. Certainly people in the northern counties will have the better chance because they're closer to where those birds are coming from. But if there's enough of a failure of food in Canada and everybody's bailing out just because there's nothing to stick around for, there's a pretty good chance of them to move around anywhere in the state, and especially the Niger seed for the pine siskins and the common red poles, and as Noel mentioned, the bigger seeds for the grosbeaks, the sunflower seed or safflower, those are very attractive. And just keep the feeders full and keep a watch on it. You never know what will show up in a year like this when at least we know the birds are present and mm-hmm. maybe just get lucky enough they might just visit your feeders for a little while as well.
And is Niger seed the same as thistle or is that different?
Yeah. People have preferred, I guess, the name Niger. It's not really a true thistle
okay.
to begin with. And since we do have the Canada thistle, which is a European invasive,
right?
We're trying to get rid of thistles. Most of the time, the
okay.
Niger has been kind of the preferred market name, I guess.
Okay, but they're the really yeah. tiny black
very
seeds.
Small
yeah,
seeds,
very small.
And that's what those little birds are looking for.
Okay.
And, that'll attract them to the feeders.
Well, we have some more audio here. We have a pine grosbeak as well, and I believe that's another one of the birds that you saw recently, Bill?
I did not.
Oh, you did not?
Yet. But now we'll see what happens.
Well, let's give a listen, because you said when we listened to the evening grosbeak, you said there's something just very grosbeak about it. So let's see what the pine grosbeak sounds like. So what stands out for you on that, Noel?
Well, that's not a bird that you and I hear that sound here this time of year. That's one of the problems going in and listening to bird sounds, because so many, if not the great majority, of the records or recordings that you'll hear will be either the song that they sing during a breeding season.
So that's actually their spring call.
Yes. This time of year, especially the finches, just have a call note. And for example, red crossbills and white-winged crossbills, and they vary. And that's the way that most people identify when there's crossbills around, just hearing their flight call when they're flying across, and just like Bill did with the evening grosbeak. So it's a whole different set of sounds that you have to learn and get attuned to this time of year compared during the breeding season.
All right, and we also have pine siskin, and now I'm not 100% sure if it's a sound we'll be hearing this time of year or not, but let's listen, and you two can tell us. This is the pine siskin. So, Bill, what were we hearing there?
That's fairly typical. You had a pretty good flock there, too, so it was a number of individuals, it sounded like. And they sound to me quite a bit like the American goldfinch. So it does have that little twittery call to it. But they have that little rising trill, and that's what distinguishes them. And that will set them apart every time. So you could hear it in part of that song, that little bit of a rising sort of a little slurred rising trill. And that's very diagnostic for a pine siskin.
It's a very nice call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're great birds, and when they're in a nice flock, you'll hear a little bit of sound and music out there. And especially this time of year, you know, the woods are very vacant, the leaves are down, it seems a little drab out there and very, very open. But they liven it up. They certainly bring some life to the woods.
Well, and this information was coming from a publication called Wisconsin's Winter Finch Update. Is that right, Noel, that you had sent? And actually, I put a link to that on the Facebook page as a comment to today's status. So there's a link there, Wisconsin Winter Finch Update, that we've been talking about. It's about a 12-page PDF file. It's got lots of great photos and information. But if you do not use Facebook or aren't comfortable going to that, you can also email us at talk@WPR.org. That's talk, T-A-L-K, at WPR.org. And you can say that you would like the Finch update, and Dave Potraz, our on-air producer, will be happy to send that out to you. So, again, you can either go to our Facebook page or you can email talk@WPR.org, and we can do that.
And for each species, there's tips for finding them as part of this. So, as you said, not only are there great photographs and their occurrence and kind of what's happening, but places to find them. For example, you look for red and white winged crossbills in, say, white spruce and maybe pine trees or tamarack. They're eating of conifer cone seeds.
Hmm.
So, you know, each of these birds have their own specific diet. One bird that's included in there, which is not a finch, which is also showing up, which we don't often get here in the southern part of the state, are Bohemian waxwings. They're the larger cousin of our familiar cedar waxwing that breed here and are here throughout the year. Bohemians only come down in the winter. And one of the hot spots for Bohemian waxwings, crossbills, and even some evening grosbeaks is Grant Park on the south side of Milwaukee in the last couple of weeks.
Great. Well, let's go back to the phones, and Joe in Trempealeau is next. Hi, Joe.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to share with your guest. I was out duck hunting on the Mississippi River 2 weeks ago. Had a flock come into right over my decoys. There's a flock of about 20 ducks. and there was drakes and hens mixed together. And the only thing I could tell was that the drakes were very white, had a yellow beak. They were eiders. I had a duck set a distance guide with me, looked at that, and I can only assume that with the storms out east, that's what drove them into the Mississippi River. So I'll take any comments off the air.
Okay.
But I'm very, very, very sure they were eiders from the Atlantic Flyway. So,
That's a trip, Joe. One of the things we'd request you to do for these really rare birds like eiders, you know, very often we don't get any sightings in the state at all during the year. Sometimes maybe only one, maybe two. You can go into the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology website, and there's a place to write records up for new species that you're seeing. So that would be great if you could do that.
And that is WSO Birds.
Correct.
Correct. Right. So WSO, like Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, birds.org. Thanks for that call, Joe. And has there been a lot of impact on the birds we're seeing here because of Hurricane Sandy and the tremendous disturbance on the East Coast?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, not that we've noticed so far, but we'll see what sort of sightings we have. But I think that Joe has a good point there. You had this large storm with the winds whipping around it in a counterclockwise fashion, and the eiders are coming from the central part of the subarctic and Arctic region and tend to winter offshore along the North Atlantic. Could have been very likely that they just picked up on those winds and were pushed into Wisconsin. And so, riding on the wind, sometimes it gets you where you want to, sometimes it'll blow you way off course, and that's what keeps it interesting.
And Jenny in Tomahawk is up next. Hi, Jenny.
Oh, thank you for having such a nice program.
Sure.
I'm calling, I don't have anything to do with the calls of the birds, but I want to tell you an interesting thing that happened with Hummer.
Sure.
This was a few years ago when they were telling you not to put the feeders out after the 1st of September because it would make them linger.
Mm.
They used to say that.
Okay.
And so it was about the 29th to 30th of August, and the bird feeder, my Hummer feeder, was empty. And what I had been doing was wait till it's empty and then bring it in and fill it, because where I had it was hanging in the sun, and I didn't want, it to get rancid. And so I hadn't filled it, and there was a Hummer out there. So I decided to go and put some in because maybe it was just coming through and didn't have any, something to eat. So I went and got the feeder and filled it or whatever and hung it back up, and immediately a Hummer came to eat there. But now this comes the interesting part. After it had eaten, it came to my, I had a picture window on a corner of my kitchen, and I was there doing dishes and watching the bird at the same time. He flew over to this big picture window like you could have over a kitchen sink, and he went three or four times around the glass, making a mm-hmm. rectangle, flying just around the edge of the rectangle
uh-huh.
three or four times. And I know he was thanking me.
Oh, well, that's a great story, Jenny. And Bill, have you ever heard of anything like that?
Well, I guess we may read into it that the bird is personally thanking us. It may have been attracted to either insects there that it might have been picking up on a warm day, or even reflections of something red through the glass, which is always attracted to hummingbirds. But as you mentioned early on, there is that myth, and Noel hinted at this at the beginning of the program, about not leaving hummingbird feeders up too late in the season because we hold them back from migration. They move by the changing of the season and shortening of the day length, and especially with these late sightings of the Rufus Allen hummingbirds that we've had, don't worry about keeping your feeders out too long and that you're going to keep the birds behind. They'll move on their own when the season is right.
Well, thanks for that call. And we have just a few minutes left, and there are a few things that I want to make sure we touch on. A couple of things. I wanted to let people know that I did get that photo of the snowy owl eating a toad that Noel referred to. It's up on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show, and Mealer is M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Sometimes that's hard for people to suss out. It's an amazing photo. You'll really want to see that. And the other is a link to the mnemonics page that Noel referred to as well earlier in the show. That is a whole list of memory devices for identifying and remembering bird calls. So there's a link to that list as well as the link to the Wisconsin Winter Finch Update, which you can either download there. It's a PDF file, or you can email talk@wpr.org and ask for a copy of the Finch Update. You know, we talked about deer hunting season already. Bill, you being up in your tree stand, keeping track of your birds. There's some great uses for the parts of the deer that people won't be eating themselves that can help our bird population. Noel, you want to touch on that?
Yes, I have some ribs of deer. I allow a bow hunter to hunt on my property, and he got a really beautiful 8-pointer. I said, the only thing I want in return, you have to return the ribs. I typically prefer the whole rib cage, and I hang it on an old swing set that the kids had in the backyard. But he cut them all up, so I put a wire through the flesh part of them and hung them up. They're hanging right near my sunflower feeder and thistle feeder, and we have chickadees and nuthatches and downing hairy and red-bellied woodpeckers coming to that. And they'll completely clean those rib bones completely free of all the flesh and fat that's on them.
And you can also use the deer suet, right, for the birds? Is that something you do, Bill?
I don't, but the suet, yeah, people have used that for a long time for the woodpeckers and other birds. And you can go to the butcher to get it or use the fat, of course, out of the deer. I stopped hanging a lot of suet around my house because I've got wood siding, and my siding is pretty well riddled from woodpeckers. I don't need to lure too many in.
You don't need to lure any more close to the house?
Yeah, they've pretty well done a job on it over the years. So, we try to, we don't discourage them here, of course, but we don't encourage them right near the house either.
And we had an email that I wanted to get to here. Let me pull it up here. Barry emails, and we only have about a minute left, but Noel and Bill, can you just, in one word answer, what was the coolest bird that each of you has seen in Wisconsin?
Well, this year I certainly know what it was, and that was a scissor-tail flycatcher that spent a couple of days with us here in Ozaukee County.
Wow.
I spent 6 hours out there making sure that everyone that showed up, because it went on the hotline and all the eBird lists and so forth, and in a six-hour period, I had 55 different people stop by to see the bird, and it was an adult male scissor-tail flycatcher.
Wow.
It was wonderful.
And Bill, what about you?
Well, you're kind of stumping me. I enjoy them all. They're just so extraordinary. I think probably one of the better experiences was watching a cerulean warbler up close, and I think more than just the bird, it's sometimes the day, the atmosphere, the place,
sure,
just that whole experience. And it was just fun to see him again, and just to know that a bird that is declining is still out there and doing fairly well in some corners of the state, and we always wish them well and hope that we can help them.
Sure. Bill and Noel, as always, thank you so much for spending your Thanksgiving with us.
I'm going home and eat some turkey.
Good. Thank you so much. Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright join us for many holidays to talk about birds. I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for tuning in to the Ideas Network.